And good evening and welcome to Sitka High School's 2018 State House Forum. We're coming to you live over Raven Radio, KCAW Sitka, and our sister station KFSK in Petersburg. I'm reporter Emily Kwong, and I'm honored to be turning over the mic to juniors in Howard Wayne's American Government class. 90 students have whittled down a list of fascinating questions for our candidates. They are your hosts. To my right and to your left are your candidates. Sitka Democrat Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, the District 35 representative since 2012, and Sitka Republican Dr. Richard Mean, a retired surgeon and assembly member who is running for that seat. House District 35 includes Sitka, Petersburg, and several small communities. Petersburg Republican Michael Sheldon is also running as a write-in and could not be with us tonight. To my left, I have juniors Malin Marius, Yuli Nori, and Dominic Pachoco. They will pose student-generated questions to each candidate. We'll take a break around 7:30. And when we reconvene, juniors Carrie Beth Gundren and Nellie Onalik will pose questions submitted by you all on paper or emailed in advance through the news department. They'll explain that to you shortly. We will not be taking any other questions through email at this time. At 7:50, the candidates will pose a question to each other and have a moment to make a final closing statement. And now, without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Dominic with some house rules. Take it away.
Hello. I'd like to begin by reviewing the format for the forum tonight. There will be no opening statements, and candidates will begin by responding to questions made by Sitka High School government students. Tiffany Elefante is our official timekeeper, and she is responsible for keeping time. Tiffany will hold up a yellow card when the candidate has 30 seconds left and a red card when the time has expired. The moderator shall be responsible for enforcing timelines and will allow candidates to complete their thought within a reasonable amount of time if they go over the limit. Some other rules for tonight are that candidates and their supporters should not bring posters, stickers, buttons, or other campaign-related props. And the live audience will hold their applause during the forum to ensure that the radio can hear all the candidate comments.
Thank you to both Representative Christ Tompkins and Dr. Reen for participating tonight. We'll be passing paper and pencils through the audience tonight and encourage audience members to write questions that we will ask during the second half of our program. Please remember to include your name along with your question. Raise your hand if you would like a card. A coin toss before the forum will determine who leads off on the first question and then closing statement. The starting order will alternate through the rest of the forum. Representative Christ Tompkins won the toss, so the first question will go to him. Representative Christ Tompkins. Junior Brandon Winston asks, if equal rights amendments were initiated by Congress, would you support the ratification in Alaska?
Thank you for the question, and I think I'm audible here. The ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, I think was first circulating in Congress well before I was born in the 70s. So I'm familiar with it as a note in history, but I'm actually not all that savvy because it hasn't been recently proposed with what its implications would be. So I'm certainly all for equality and equal pay and sort of other aspects of gender equity, but the ERA, it's been a while, so I certainly want to do my diligence before really diving in on the ratification book.
Dr. Wayne, same question?
The truth is, that's how I live my life, with the notion of equal rights. So there's no amendment that I feel is needed, and should there be one that is positive, I would definitely support it. Of course, we live in a modern, diverse society, and we need to respect that. And so I would fully support it.
Dr. Lee, question from Malin Marius. Do you support any limitations to the Second Amendment?
That's a difficult question because there are limitations. There are numerous laws that exist, and I accept those laws, but I do support the Second Amendment. Obviously, there's nothing that exists without limitation, and we do have those limitations on the books, and I do believe that they need to be enforced as appropriately as they can be. And as we have seen in the news and so forth, that many of these laws have actually been ignored. You can see in certain cities and states, whether it be Chicago or places like New Jersey, where they have very stringent gun laws, actually gun crime is actually fairly rampant. And so it becomes very problematic. There are limits to things, but I am a supporter of the Second Amendment. And for your class, I think it's important to recognize what the founding fathers thought of when they installed the Second Amendment and what its actual purpose was. And I think that is something very important to consider. So to summarize, yes, there are limits, and they do exist. And I also support the Second Amendment. Thank you.
Any questions?
Thank you. The Second Amendment,
sort of cornerstones of law in this country, and I respect and support that. And as Dr. Wien mentioned, the question is, you know, where is the right balance? Because nothing is absolute or without limitation. And there are laws already that relate to when access to firearms should be limited. There are background checks. Those, in my mind, make sense. They're already the law of the land. Alaska doesn't have them. This is federal law. And also, as Dr. Wien alluded, there are some loopholes there that certainly, in my mind, make sense to address. And where limitations come in, I think it's all pretty common sense, probably nothing that anyone in this room would disagree with. It's instances of mental illness. Probably doesn't make a lot of sense to have somebody who's been clinically diagnosed as being a dangerous person to him or herself or to society have access to weapons that can kill a lot of people very quickly. And again, I think that's generally within the bounds of some law that's already on the books. And then also criminal history. You know, if you have a murderer who, for whatever reason, is, you know, out on parole or probation, probably doesn't make a lot of sense to have that person have access to firearms. So limitations like that certainly pass the common sense test in my mind. So the Second Amendment, it's something this country is built on. I respect that. And the question is, where is the right balance? And some of the points I spoke to, certainly in my mind, pass the common sense test.
Representative Chris Tompkins, would you actively oppose mining projects by large rivers that are vital to salmon? Asked by John Walsh.
Yeah, it's a great and very relevant question right now. Along with Representative Ortez and Ketchikan, an independent, he and I have teamed up on a number of letters to the congressional delegation, to the U.S. Secretary of State, as well as past resolutions in the Alaska legislature relating to the development of large mines on transboundary waters in southeast Alaska. And that's, in my mind, a grave concern to our fisheries, especially when you look at the Mount Pauley disaster in Canada and how that has decimated sockeye runs in the Fraser River in Canada and destroyed the way of life of First Nations people in British Columbia. And the possibility of that happening in Alaska, even though it's a Canadian mine, we're downriver, southeast Alaska is downriver, is concerning to me. So we have been highly active on that issue. I met in person with the International Joint Commission, which is one of these obscure bureaucratic international bodies which has jurisdiction over transboundary waterways between the United States and Canada in Washington, D.C. 4 years ago, and this was all just getting going as a part of that advocacy. So to directly and squarely answer the question, yes, I am concerned. I have taken action that represents Alaska's interest, our sovereign interest, and the interest of fishermen here and people who rely on seafood for their way of life, and will continue to do so going forward.
Dr. Ween, same question.
Well, the mine that is being mentioned in the transboundary, meaning it's in Canada, but the runoff and tributaries come into Alaska, is called the Red Chris Mine. And part of the problem with that is that Canada did not really require them to have a fully funded mitigation fund, where people, before you start mining, you put money into the bank in case something happens that you can take care of it. One of the things in Alaska permitting is that they require upfront, full-funded mitigation. So that's what makes us different than Canada. I think that the Red Chris mine in the transboundary is a very important lesson, and it shows that we need to, I'll say, more forcefully require those individuals to up their permitting process. As far as whether would I oppose anything near large waters, well, we live in a state with laws, and anybody who wishes to, I'll say, make a mine can legally start a permitting process. And I think that is the question: will you not permit these things, and which is different than oppose them? And my notion is, since it is legal to obtain permits for these things, let's see what they want to do and how they're going to do it. So I'm not going to make any specific judgment. Thank you.
Dr. Ween, Jake Falvey asks, should Alaska penalize first-time opiate offenders with jail time, or should they be offered a rehab program instead?
I think the opioid problem is very significant, and there are really several elements to the opioid issue. You have the, I'll say, the medical world problem, where physicians have prescribing, and certainly certain physicians have overprescribed, and but the state has established a registry, and people are being monitored quite substantially. To me, the real concern is the illegal market, and that is the one that is essentially uncontrolled. You have drugs coming in from all over, I think that this is the area that needs to be dealt with. Now to answer the question, as the first-time offender, and I assume it's going to be illegal drugs, clearly that individual needs the ability to seek treatment and understand the possibility of not using these opioids in the future. So, yes, I would support treatment, certainly in those cases.
Representative Christ Tompkins, same question.
It's a personal question. To me, I think probably to a lot of people in the room, some of my classmates, when I would have been sitting at that table as a high school student, are no longer with us from overdoses, and I can think of a couple of people that fall in that category, sadly, and unfortunately, I think that's probably true for all too many people. Last fall, I helped organize a series of town hall events with the chief medical officer for the state of Alaska, Dr. Jay Butler, one here in Sitka, just across the hall, here in the Centennial Building and in Prince of Wales and Petersburg, and meeting with those who've rehabbed from opiate addiction, law enforcement, medical professionals, to sort of look at the different dimensions of the issue. And I think that's really helped sort of inform my views on the problem and what a problem it is. It's a scourge. It's an epidemic. It's been declared a disaster in the state of Alaska. And I mean, to come around to, I think what the question is teasing out, the differentiation between users and dealers, I think it is appropriate to differentiate, and not just appropriate, but really necessary. And as Dr. Wien said, first-time users, you want to have a pathway to treatment, to rehabilitation, and to redemption. And that pathway exists is hugely important, so that there's not this devolution into patterns of criminal behavior or worse. For dealers and traffickers, however, criminal sanction is appropriate and should exist. And making sure, as an aside, that there are the resources, the prosecuting attorneys, and a functioning judicial system to be able to criminally sanction dealers and traffickers is important, and something the legislature has looked at this last year or two. So I think that differentiation is really important, and agree that the first-time users need to be treated differently.
Representative Chris Tompkins. Alice Howard asks, do you support equal rights for gay people?
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Wien, same question.
In this day and age, I'm surprised it's a question. And the answer is clearly absolutely. It's one of those questions that you don't have to say anymore to understand the meaning.
Cora Dow asks, regarding logging, what is your opinion on President Trump's plan to repeal the roadless rule in the Tongass National Forest? Dr. Wien, you have first asked.
The roadless rule is very interesting because in the Tongass there are a lot of roads. And in discussion with Forest Service people, that at least within their opinion, there is room for considering what they call limited exemption as being very reasonable. In my opinion, however, I will take it another step further. I do believe in the Alaska exemption for the roadless rules. And the reason I believe in that is because we are in a state which requires our ability to be able to consider resource usage, and hopefully in a very smart way. And when we do that, we need, I'll say, all of our tools on the table. If we don't get the exemption, then we are hamstringed and we are unable to promote ideas which may be beneficial to the state. I believe that places in POW, for example, again, Viking Lumber and lots of other small outfits which are logging, I think that at Viking they employ a stream of people of about 235, and that is a significant number of people from Craig and Klawock and other areas. And to deny a constant stream of selective logging, et cetera, I think is not appropriate. And Alaska needs all the tools that it has on the table to make appropriate decisions on how to deal with the resources that that we have. And I'm sure you know about the financial aspects and troubles that we're having in this state. So it's not a bad idea to have the tools. Thank you.
Representative Chris Tompkins, same question.
Over the last, gosh, probably 5 to 8 years, there's been a multi-party working group, timber industry, fishing, conservation, visitor tourism industry, basically looking at the future of the management of the Tongass National Forest. And from me sort of being a bit afield from that, but watching that group work and sort of progressively home in on consensus, because this is such a divisive issue, the Tongass Timber Wars have, you know, torn apart this community, a lot of communities, very, very polarizing. That process, really looking at consensus, really impressed me, and trying to sort of turn a new page in terms of management of the Tongass. And so, I was very partial to the work that group was doing, which I think has sort of been put on pause, as best I understand it. So, I'm very partial to that sort of consensus-based approach. I mean, I'm sort of watching and seeing what unfolds in terms of a possible Alaska exemption. Governor Walker has appointed a working group. Sitka has representation on that working group. So, you know, the details matter. But in general, when it comes to management of the Tongass, that kind of consensus-based process, in my mind, is the way to go in order to try to put the Tongass timber wars behind us and sort of have a consensus-oriented management approach of this forest.
Okay, Joel Arce asks, in the Philippines, we read school prayer on the intercom. Should we be allowed to do the same in Alaska? Representative Christ Tompkins?
Well, I think this probably runs into a constitutional issue. In other states, if I'm not mistaken, where this has been tried or proposed, it usually gets struck down by the courts and under the on the grounds of the First Amendment, and I suspect the same would be true here in Alaska. And I mean, I think that clean separation does make a lot of sense. Otherwise, it gets really messy really quickly and really emotional and divisive. I would prefer to keep things how they are. Basically, it seems to work well. But that's not to say that you can't embrace, encourage, and create a space for religion, prayer, spirituality, whatever, and you know, the First Amendment also encourages that and the freedom to express that. I think there's lots of room and appropriate space to pursue religious thought and religious expression without it coming over the school intercom.
Dr. Wayne.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. I went to public school, and that is how we started our day. Things have changed. Our view of the law has been established, and these have been tried successfully in relation to the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment and period. And there has been a separation made, and as we are a nation of laws, there's a prayer in school, though is an issue, seems to be, has a legal basis to have it removed. And so I have to support the current law of the land. So.
Dr. Wien, what is your plan to help prevent school shootings in Alaska?
A couple of things. One is, I know we have the ALICE program here in Sitka, and that students have been practicing in an effort to have a heightened awareness, and that's certainly one thing that's important. To have a mental set, and teachers, students, as well as the police department. It's a good thing that that we're in Sitka, because things are very close, and response times can be very rapid. I know that school shootings are something that is a consideration, but if you look at the school shootings, there were a lot of warning signs about the individuals who perpetrated these things. And I think that it's important to, one, to be able to recognize those potential perpetrators and remove them from the school and provide them with treatment. The only mass casualty that I can remember in Sitka was actually performed by a knife. And multiple people were stabbed in a rageful situation of mental illness. So the thing is that school shootings are important, and we have ALICE and awareness. But it is not just shootings. You know, it depends on the individual. A determined individual can create a lot of damage without having a gun. And so it's awareness and knowing what to do when the time comes, which I think will be, I'll say, our savior.
Representative Christ Tompkins, same question.
It's such a difficult difficult question, and there's no easy answer. There's certainly no, I think, proven answer, given sort of the increasing frequency around the nation, and fortunately it hasn't really come to Alaska, notwithstanding the incident in Bethel, I think 20 or so years ago. And actually, the legislator in the House of Representatives from Bethel, Representative Tsulkowski, she was actually a student at Bethel Regional High School when that shooting happened. And she related it to me and other colleagues earlier this year, and it was pretty impactful. It seems like there's this trend towards armoring schools, almost as though schools are becoming the equivalent of the post TSA zone of an airport, and I find that sad and reactive. And I mean, given that they're community institutions and they're a place where you want them to feel welcoming and open, I imagine in some situations, in certain measure, that's appropriate. But certainly it doesn't address the root cause, which is you have people who feel antipathy towards society, towards their fellow man and woman, and have a sort of violent impulse with, you know, whatever it is that person is feeling. And in my mind, you want to drive towards the root symptom, and that's, you know, a strong institution of public education that is able to identify and support students who are struggling with mental health or social alienation. And you want a safety net that can, in sort of a public health approach, also identify and support those individuals. And that feels like it gets a little bit more to the root situation. And I don't know how much its government is going to catalyze that. I think it's really, you know, up to a lot of us as individuals looking out for each other and trying to help each other, you know, approaching each other with kindness. So, tough question. Those are a couple of the thoughts that come to mind.
Olivia Wilcox asks our next question. Should safe abortion options and clinics be available to women in Alaska? Representative Christ Hopkins, you can leave.
Yes. It's legal in the United States, at least per Roe v. Wade, has been for a long time. That continues to be the law of the land, and I respect that and support that. And at the same time, I think everybody can agree we want abortion to be as scarce as possible, as rare as possible. And I think that starts, you know, with education, sex education, helping people make smart personal life choices, understand, especially, you know, young people, make sure that they have the information needed to be making responsible decisions and decisions that are good for them. So, in my mind, that should be the goal, because there's no undoing what the law of the land is. I mean, maybe the new Supreme Court is going to go in a different direction, and then it's a whole new ball game. But given where we're at right now, I think safe, rare, and legal, which is a phrase I think from the 90s, but that certainly resonates with me, and I'd like to think each of those elements is something that a lot of us can agree on. So the direct answer is yes, but as rarely as possible.
Dr. Wien, you may respond.
I respond to this as a physician surgeon. It is my, and that makes me different than, a political view or a personal, college dorm room argument view. And that is, as a physician and surgeon, I have to be advocate for patients. And, therefore, I have to deal with all of their needs. And I think that when you think of actually Roe v. Wade, it's more than 45 years old. And It is a Latin term. It's called stare decisis, meaning let it stand, or it's precedent or settled law. And I think it would be a grave error, because I am old enough to have seen the ravages of abortions that have occurred through perforation and the development of sepsis and emergency hysterectomies. And my notion is that those days must not come back. But as part of a caveat that reproductive biology and knowledge is so advanced that there is very, very little reason to obtain an abortion due to I forgot or something like that. So the numbers of abortion should be pretty close to zero if we make birth control available, inexpensive, and teach people how to use it, period. So I think it it, as much as I dislike the notion, I don't believe in going back in time on this, because people are going to be hurt, because women will seek what is necessary to them, and therefore I would certainly support it. And looking around here, I think I'm the only person who's ever done a DNC. So, thank you.
Chloe Audette asks, do you believe the death penalty would be a good solution to help reduce prison costs? Dr. Ween?
The death penalty is an interesting notion. Clearly, if you're not having to have somebody there with three hots and a cot, you're reducing cost, but I don't think that that's the issue. And when you're dealing with human issues such as this, you know, cost should not be taken into consideration. And that is, though certain people who have committed heinous acts, your initial reaction is to that it is an eye for an eye. But I feel that ultimately this is a no-go place to be. As much as I would like to see those people pay the ultimate price, again, as a physician, I have to deal with the humanity of things, and would say that I probably would not support a death penalty based on cost. To me, that doesn't make any sense.
Representative Christ-Tompkins?
As I understand it, it's actually it's a fact that the death penalty costs more than life imprisonment because of all the due process associated with capital punishment, the exhaustive appeals process, sort of reviews after reviews after reviews, a capital punishment case actually costs more than lifetime imprisonment. So, I mean, just to speak to the premise of the question, that doesn't compute mathematically to me, or if you look at other states as a case study. But looking at sort of the bigger principles at play, I'm sort of looking around the room to see if Fairbanks 4 sort of rings any bells with people. But obviously, up north, an interior issue attracted a lot of statewide headlines, but it was four young Native men who were tried and convicted of a murder, a heinous murder in Fairbanks, and it was a wrongful conviction. The state withdrew its conviction earlier this year. So there are miscarriages of justice, and the notion of executing an innocent person to me is such a moral wrong, such a moral risk and harm that the institution of capital punishment is highly questionable. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. And especially having followed the process of the Fairbanks Four be exonerated and be released, they're now back in society, they were innocent, I think has really hammered that home. And there's issues of racial equity and how people who are poor, who don't have access to top flight defense attorneys, who fit a stereotype, can be unjustly prosecuted because they don't have access to those resources. It gives me a lot of pause when thinking about certainly the death penalty, but more in general sort of social justice and racial equity issues in the criminal justice system.
Katie Sweeney asks, what do you think marijuana has done for Alaska since it has been legalized? Representative Christ Tompkins?
And I'm sorry, could you read the question just once
more? Yes. What do you think marijuana has done for Alaska since it has been legalized?
Marijuana's been around legally for, I guess, 4 years now. And from my perspective, the sky has not fallen. When the initiative was up, as of now, I have never inhaled in my life, never when I was in high school, not now. Doesn't do my running times any favors, I figure. I think as a matter of public policy, it makes sense. In a certain sense, alcohol is much greater likelihood to create, you know, criminal behavior or violence, domestic violence. Marijuana tends to have the opposite effect. At this point, the marijuana industry in Alaska is actually generating net revenue even after regulatory costs. And that trend line is only going to increase. And certainly having all that money out of the black market as it was, which was really indirectly financing criminal behavior, and out in the open in a transparent system with private entrepreneurs, private enterprise, also makes a huge amount of sense to me. So the way it's played out, I think it's been thoughtfully regulated. There's still improvements that need to be made. I think we're in a good place and going in a better place.
Thank you. Dr. Ween, same question.
All I can say is I have inhaled, and when I was younger, it was mostly seeds and stems. It's not like today, which is highly genetically refined with high levels of THC, and at that time, it was like $5, and now it's 150. But I'd like to report that I am the president of Alaska's Doctors for Doobies and Pilots for Pot. And the reason I say that is because, would you imagine what would happen if, before going into surgery, I would say, excuse me, to the family and say, I just want to take a toke or something. Or if your pilot you saw waiting outside before he entered the plane, just take a, what is it called, the blunt, to do that. So clearly what happens is there are certain people you do not want to be smoking. And THC, by the way, is not like alcohol. Alcohol is what's called first kinetic degradation in the body. It's fairly standard as to the time it leaves. But marijuana can be in your system for up to 30 days. And therefore, as a high school student, you smoke on Friday night, maybe Saturday night, you know what? You still have a level in your system on Monday morning. And let me tell you, there is nothing that anybody here can do better than me who's stoned except eat pizza or Sara Lee banana cake. And the important thing is here is that it's one thing to smoke on an occasion, but what's happening now is there are chronics. And there are increasing reports in literature, especially pediatric literature, where there are increased visits to the emergency room, etc. And I think that though marijuana has been legalized, its basic result is that it has allowed greater access. And I think it's going to be very problematic in the future. Thank you.
Cora Dow asks, what would you do to make healthcare more affordable and available for those who need it in Alaska? Dr. Ween, you may respond first.
Okay. The first thing to understand is that healthcare is one of the main drivers in the state budget. And I feel that that is something actually unique I can bring to the legislature. I have a great administrative experience in medical management, as well as knowing what infantry is, being down and having to struggle with insurance companies, have to advocate for patients, have to guide patients through the myriad of the maze that is created, which is highly wasteful to physician time, to hospital staff time, and only creates barriers. And so there are many things that that we can do At the state level, I think to refine our ability to allow greater efficiencies within medicine, and I think it takes a physician to do it. A lot of times legislators are dealing with second and tertiary people in how they make judgments, but if I'm actually have experienced it, there are things that I can parse out from the details which could help direct that. I also believe if you increase the efficiencies that you will be able to treat more patients. And so the bottom line is that I think that we can rationalize our system here in Alaska, and I think that I certainly would like the privilege of being able to utilize my skill for that. There's a lot of room to change, even though it is 2018, we still haven't gotten the system down.
Representative Chris Tompkins, you may respond.
First off, I'm a supporter of Medicaid expansion, which Governor Walker brought to Alaska 2 to 3 years ago, and particularly for rural and coastal communities like this one, Masika Community Hospital, Petersburg Medical Center, to the listeners over there. Medicaid expansion has been hugely important financially for the solvency of those institutions. So I respect that, and I support that, and if there's a Dunleavy administration, I will protect that, as will the bipartisan coalition in the House that is Medicaid expansion. And I think some of the impacts of that are you no longer have multi-hundred thousand or even seven-figure charity care bills that hospitals are saddled with, because by law they have to provide charity care to anybody who comes in the ER door. And those numbers have been turned into a fraction of what they once were, because you no longer have an uninsured population seeking care, but people are covered under Medicaid expansion, which in a moral way, in a public policy way, and in a financial way makes a lot of sense to me, and I will continue to support and defend that going forward. I think there's also a couple of considerations, especially on the federal level, I think it's really important that the state advocate to our congressional delegation and federally that people with pre-existing conditions continue to be covered, that they can't be denied insurance. That's a fundamental issue to a lot of people. And fortunately, I think we've got that right in the U.S., and I want to make sure that it stays that way. And then lastly, the system is, a warren of paperwork and highly inefficient and wasteful with insurance companies and providers. And you have some providers that are making out like bandits, particularly specialists up in Anchorage. There's been some reports of that. So looking at that and trying to make the system sustainable also strikes me as highly important with healthcare.
Max Johnson asks, what is your position on offshore exploration for fossil fuels in Alaska? Representative Chris Tompkins.
It's very circumstantial. Oil is a lot easier to clean up on land than in water, that's for certain. And there's been some offshore exploration just off the North Slope that has been done for a while now and has been done responsibly and been done very well. Small artificial islands, I think the Liberty Prospect just off the North Slope is one of them. That makes sense to me. It's been proven, it's been demonstrated as responsible development. When you start to go further offshore, I think the number of questions compounds rapidly. There's certainly potential, but of course the risks also heighten. The Deepwater Horizon incident in the Gulf of Mexico was, to me at least, sobering. I remember the sort of day-by-day progression of they were trying to put trash to plug the hole at one point, and it was sort of a comedy of errors with colossal implications, catastrophic implications in the Gulf of Mexico, to the economy and to the environment. And the thought of an incident like that happening, but in Arctic conditions with sea ice is a little bit mind-boggling. So there's no active proposals for that kind of development right now, since Shell withdrew from its Chukchi prospects after they basically drilled some dry holes, some dry exploration holes. There just wasn't the hydrocarbons there for them to extract. So it's not a clear and present question right now, but were it ever to come back, I think there would have to be a lot of diligence, although I'm hesitant to say make any absolute statements. I think it's very circumstantial, and you need to look at the details of the proposal and then weigh pros and cons and go from there.
Dr. Wayne?
Well, the answer that I have is I certainly would support offshore drilling. Technology is has advanced in the petroleum industry amazingly, and that they can drill down 30,000 feet, they can do lateral drills, the ability to explore and find oil deposits is just incredible. And believe it or not, I can't give you the number, but there are an enormous number of offshore drilling rigs within the United States. And Norway, I think, is the classic example of offshore drilling, which makes them the Shangri-La of a country, because they obtain those revenues. I think there are disasters that have occurred. But I think that does not mean that we should inhibit a well-thought-out project from proceeding. And I certainly would encourage the companies to continue to explore and do these things. You have to understand something, that Bloomberg Financial just a short time ago said the total drilling in a day is 100 million barrels, and this is a number that has been increasing. Clearly there is demand, and this demand in our current world of 8 billion people is not going to go away. So if Alaska can do it well and do it safely, then I certainly would have no objection.
Dr. Wien. Sid Fleming asks, do you believe that illegal immigrants in Alaska should be deported immediately?
Immigration is an interesting notion. There are actually two types of immigration. There is that aspect where there's legal immigration, where you go through a process which is lawful, and that is something that has gone on in this country since its founding. However, there is a concept of illegal immigration, and what constitutes a country is a border. And, you know, why is Italy Italy, and why is France France? It's because they had some concept of borders. We know what has happened after World War One, when all the borders were just changed all over, and various ethnic groups were now crowded into borders which were not natural to them, and, definite problems occurred. So the question is, should they be deported immediately? We have process in this country, and I believe that even those who enter into this country illegally are part of that process. So should they be deported immediately? If they are known to be criminals, I would say yes. But I think regular people need to go through whatever that process we have now and to determine if their stay in this country is appropriate. So that is where I stand on. Thank you.
Representative Chris Tompkins?
Generally speaking, sort of draconian, the draconian hand of government coming in and tearing apart families, I think is really to be avoided. This is a federal issue. It's not a state issue. So as far as what the state of Alaska government is going to do, there's not, I think, probably a huge amount of relevance. But as a matter of principle, I think it's really unfortunate to see actions like that. And You want dignity, you want due process. And I mean, I think I was reached out to, I think it was 8 to 12 months ago, there was a woman here in Sitka who was sort of ensnared in an immigration issue. And I think to those who sort of get into the system, you know, it can sort of seem arbitrary and bureaucratic and sort of not make a lot of sense. You know, if people are contributing members of society in our communities, I think the degree to which that can be kept true makes a lot of sense to me. I think, you know, at the same time, you want strong borders and you want to encourage legal immigration, not illegal immigration, and the degree to which that can be accomplished is all the better. But this is a federal issue, not a state issue. So those are my thoughts, but not terribly relevant to what the state of Alaska is going to do.
Allison Winger asks, what are your views on changing Alaska's law to require students to stay in school until they're 18? Representative Chris Tompkins, you may speak first.
Gosh, I'm trying to think if there was a piece of legislation to that effect. Well, right now, if I'm not mistaken, the law in Alaska is you have to be in school until the age of 16. I'm seeing sort of a lifeline nod from the educators in the audience is quite helpful. And I mean, there hasn't been a case, certainly. I'm definitely sort of the mind that if there's not a problem, you probably don't need a solution. I mean, there's certainly no shortage of problems in the world, and it makes a lot of sense to focus on the problems that are clear and obvious and evident. And so I have not been made aware, at least to date, of any direct or indirect problems associated with the current age of compulsory attendance for high school. So if it's not broke, don't fix it, I suppose. That said, there may be sort of a degree of analysis here or a silent or sort of unspoken problem that I'm not aware of, in which case I would be all ears and want to learn more. But and I mean, at the same time, this is sort of indirectly related to the question, but you know, there's a lot of people, even at the age of 16, who I think are starting to track their own life trajectories, and that, you know, may have a highly vocational bent to it, or it may be commercial fishing, it may be this or that, and having some degree of flexibility makes a lot of sense. And so I think institutions like Pacific High School, which, you know, support that kind of flexibility, or other programs like that, make a lot of sense. So and when we talk about compulsory attendance, I think, you know, you want people to sort of be on this rigid K-12 trajectory, and that works for a lot of people. But I certainly think flexibility when you start to get to that age makes a lot of sense as well.
Dr. Wayne, you may respond.
Well, I believe that any successful system would motivate students to stay in for that a recommended length of time. And therefore, we need to consider how we're educating the kids and why they would want to leave before the prescribed time. And therefore, we may need to redesign certain educational aspects in order to meet the needs, and that means improved vocational aspects, and even to bring in subsistence aspects into it. I always imagined a school, you do, you know, hunting, fishing, hiking in the morning, and do calculus in the afternoon. And because this is Alaska, and I feel that we can have a much broader, and I'll say appealing system, and that is what we need to go for. I think if people are wanting to drop out, there may be reasons, whether it has to do with family, whether it has to do with issues of bullying, whether it has to do with frustration in their ability to learn, and I think that those needs need to be met. A fallout from this is that reimbursement from the state is based on attendance, and if too many people get the idea that they can just walk, I think it can dramatically affect how education is performed in Alaska. So my notion is to create the best possible environment to encourage people to stay in school. I remember my own experience. There was discomfort at times, but it was also a wonderful experience getting through it. And I think that that needs to be replicated. And if kids are not going through, you need to find out why.
Thank you very much, both of our candidates. You can applaud now. And a hearty thank you to Malin Marius, Yuli Murray, and Dominic Bachoco for asking these questions. I know you had even more on your list, and I really thank the candidates for answering these. We're going to turn it over to audience questions now, do a little bit of musical chairs to get new student hosts. They will be reading questions that have been submitted by the audience, and candidates will have 1 minute to answer. And our timekeeper will keep you on track for that, still using the 30-second card when you have 1 minute remaining. So we're going to go to some music. You can stretch your legs, but don't go too far, and keep listening to Raven Radio, KCAW, Sitka.
My name is Nellie Onalik. Now we will begin our town hall format portion of the program, where questions will come from the audience here at the Centennial Hall and from radio listeners on KFSK Petersburg and KCA Sitka. Candidates will have 1 minute to respond to each question. And our first question is from Floyd Tompkins, and it will be answered by Representative Chris Tompkins.
You don't say.
Do you support right to repair legislation for Alaska?
Right to repair?
Correct.
I might plead conflict of interest on this question. In addition to me, there might be a handwriting issue.
Dad, where are you? Where are you? Come forward.
We're going to pick a different question. Rebecca, a KCAW listener, asked, in 2016, the state passed SB 91 and last fall passed SB 54. Both intended to reform the criminal justice system. While the sharp rise in Anchorage crime has been blamed on SB 91, public safety experts say the rise in crime has more to do with opioid addiction, the recession, and budget cuts to public safety and the judicial system, the lack of addiction treatment and other rehabilitation services. What do you believe will be most effective in reducing crime in Alaska? Representative Chris Tompkins?
Yeah, sort of an all of the above solution. So SB 91 did a lot and I think created some consequences that were really unfortunate, many of which were remedied or repaired in SB 54, which was passed earlier this year and which I also supported. And I imagine there will be more criminal justice legislation that comes forward that continues to fix problems that have come up. I mean, I think it's also... It's all complex. That's easy to say, but it's true. I mean, SB 91 also increased mandatory minimums for murder one, for instance, in Alaska. So sort of wholesale repeal. It's easy to say, but you're also repealing a lot of things that everybody would agree are a good thing. And then looking at funding for public safety and prosecutors, hugely important. It was really sort of cut to the bone over the last 5-6 years. So you had cases that were waived because there simply weren't the prosecuting attorneys to deal with them. So making those investments makes a lot of sense. And then I think recognizing that a lot of criminal behavior right now in Alaska is associated with drugs and addiction. So trying to have a solution on that side of the equation as well makes a lot of sense to me.
Now, Dr. Wien.
I think SB 91 actually turned out to be a disaster, and I think it is the modus operandi for many things. You can call it opioid addiction or cuts, but the bottom line is when you decriminalize things like heroin, et cetera, you allow a certain behavior to be accepted, and you allow an environment to exist which promotes crime. So its supposed remedy was SB 54. Read the comparisons. Both of them need to be repealed. We need to go back to the table, take our lessons learned, and craft a good legislation which doesn't allow people to just keep hitting the streets after multiple in quotes arrests, because now they're only giving tickets. And if you ask any law enforcement in Alaska what the problem is, they'll say SB 91.
Hello, my name is Carrie Beth Gundren, and this question is for Dr. Wien, asked by Autumn Dinsmore. Should the state be allowed to take money from the PFD?
Let's talk about District 35. District 35 is a wide-ranging district with actually many, I'll say, financially challenged communities. And as I've traveled around to these communities, they are very acutely aware that $1,000 was taken from them. And they view that reduction in the PFD as real, they view that money of the PFD as real income. And it's not two tickets to Honolulu, as you see advertised by Alaska Airlines, but it's actually good services, paying for their electric oil bill, getting a chainsaw, having tires. So my notion is that There is a heck of a lot more that we can do on a budgetary level as far as opening up the conversation to help preserve the PFD. And so I would say that restore the PFD and do some due diligence and better work at the table in budgetary aspects.
And Representative Chris Tompkins?
The PFD is hugely important in Alaska, and I sort of support it almost as an institution. And I think one of the best ways to sort of show respect and support for something important to Alaska, or something I think is important, is to make sure it's sustainable. I introduced legislation the last 2 years to constitutionalize the permanent fund dividend, as well as to fully protect the corpus of the fund, the proverbial golden goose. And I think not a lot of us, not of Alaskans, are aware, but actually about a third of the permanent fund, as we know it, is available for appropriation right now. And I was involved, sponsored a constitutional amendment, and worked with a lot of other legislators that would have fully protected the corpus. So as much as I support the permanent fund dividend, and we were able to settle on a $1,600 compromise figure, some people wanted zero, some people wanted $2,700. $1,600 was the amount settled on, which feels reasonable. I would like more, but I also want to make sure that this is around for 50 years, 75 years, 100 years. We need to protect the dividend and the Constitution, and we need to protect the permanent fund in its entirety permanently.
This question is asked by Jennifer. Would you join a bipartisan House coalition if it exists in the next legislative session, Mr. Representative Chris Tompkins?
Yes, very much. The bipartisan coalition, I'm a member of it right now. I was involved in creating it, and it's one of the best things going for Sitka, for this region, for coastal Alaska. It has been the firewall for ferry funding, for public radio, which many people in Sitka and Petersburg are hearing this conversation right now through. And making sure commercial fisheries funding is protected, and making sure that the interests of our communities are represented. The Speaker of the House is from Dillingham. The co-chairs of finance are from Homer and Nome. The fisheries chairman is from Kodiak. I'm the chairman of State Affairs Committee, which makes sure the capital stays in Southeast, among other issues. Coastal Alaska is supremely well represented. Our interests are well represented. And I will do everything I can to make sure the bipartisan coalition continues to represent our interests.
Dr. Ween?
Well, I think saying bipartisan coalition is like saying kitten or puppy. I would like to point out, if you look at what the bipartisan coalition is, if you look at Mr. Seaton, Representative Seaton, he went from, he changed parties and is now a Democrat. Ms. Ledoux may be representing Lemon Creek due to election irregularities, and I don't know what Representative Stutz will be doing. So whether there will be a bipartisan effort that is there is certainly up in the air. But when you say bipartisan, I'm not exactly sure what you mean. As a potential future legislator, I will vote, for example, for good legislation, and I will not vote for bad legislation, and I will not vote party line on things that are not right and are not appropriate. And so I don't know whether you call that bipartisan. I just call it good legislation. And I think that in a very real way, we need to up the game in the legislation to improve legislation, so we don't have to have these party line things. Thank you.
This next question is directed to Dr. Ween. Please explain your position on the ballot measure number 1 by Mary Solstice.
I will say it right off, and that is I support salmon because I will be voting no on ballot issue number 1. That is right off the bat. I believe that this is an ill-conceived initiative. I think it is a presumptive issue in that all dreams that have not been cataloged already, which are probably 50%, are presumed to be anadromous, meaning salmon-bearing streams. If you go to page 64 of the official election pamphlet, you can read a very good description of some of the incredible things that have to happen in trying to do things. As a SICA assembly member, I believe that the cost of business will definitely increase. I believe that projects will potentially be delayed or canceled, and I believe that this will be all over Alaska. I believe that fishing game and other regulatory agencies have been doing a good job. The amount of regulation is enormous, and I think this is a sunk cost issue, meaning that people are afraid to back out of it once they get the facts and just have to read what the requirements are. Sorry.
And Representative Chris Tompkins.
both names. Just as a sort of factual note, Representative Seaton, who was mentioned earlier, is an independent now, and wanted to speak to that. And in terms of ballot measure one, it's difficult. I think there are shortcomings in the habitat laws right now, particularly relating to public notice. And I think there's a real conundrum where you have major projects proposed in the Bristol Bay watershed, for instance, with the Pebble project. And it is reasonable to conclude, looking at the current habitat and permitting laws, that that project really wouldn't be denied, that there's no recourse for local communities and project opponents given the way permitting and habitat laws are written, which I find concerning when you have a project that is broadly opposed by Alaskans. You can look at past ballot initiatives on the matter, as well as by the people of that region. So that's a problem, and it needs a solution of some sort. It's always tricky when legislating by the ballot box, and you know, I think there's some concerns in the initiative. I'll be basically looking at what the outcome of the initiative is and want to address the problems via legislation, whether it passes or fails.
This question goes to Representative Chris Tompkins. Abe asks, given the hurtful cuts to our school district budget and other vital infrastructures, what would you do to change the state budget to help SICA?
Well, this is something I was really involved with the last couple of years, and SICA school district was really, every school district in Alaska was caught in this pretty dire budgeting situation. In the operating budget compromise this last year, the House coalition secured, I think it was an $80 million increase to public education funding, which had been flatlined for, I think, the previous five or so years. I might be off by a year or two, but all while health insurance costs and energy costs and inflation basically erode the real dollars that are going into the district. So it's, effectively these year-over-year cuts. So I think those modest increases to public education to at least keep up with inflation make a lot of sense to me, and we have walked that walk. The coalition has been able to come up with funding for public schools, which preserve programs like music and extracurricular sports and a lot of the aspects of our public education system that keep students engaged and certainly kept me engaged as a student as well.
Dr. Wayne?
You have to remember that before oil, Alaska was one of the poorest states in the Union. We're not the Fed, meaning the Federal Reserve. We can't print money. Money has to be earned. And in order to earn money, you have to support business. And therefore, you have to support all the aspects of a prosperous, diversified economy within the state. And the legislature is the driver of that. And we need to have everything on the table in order to promote a business and revenue streams, period. I feel that that is the way towards prosperity. If we do not diversify the economy and go full steam ahead with all aspects of economics, that will forever be asking the question about school funding and infrastructure, because that is what feeds District 35 in the state, is a healthy state and a healthy economy.
KCAW listener question from Daniel. Do either of you support a state payroll tax? If not, why not? It's time for the state to start getting some money back from all the seasonal employees who take all their earnings back to the lower 48. For Dr. Ween.
I come from originally New Jersey, and there are a lot of people from New Jersey who worked in Manhattan, and Manhattan didn't like the idea that they were earning their money and being taxed like New Jersey. So what they did was something very simple, and it protected people from New York. And they just issued a separate tax for those, and they would have to file a separate form on people who were not from Alaska, and they would have to just pay it. I think that we don't have to go through a payroll tax for everybody, but we can direct it as they have done in other states, which would make it simple and I think appropriate, to capture some of that money. So I think the solution is potentially straightforward.
Representative Chris Tompkins.
Most of all, I'm a supporter of a balanced budget, and a balanced budget is difficult. Alaska hasn't seen a balanced budget, a truly balanced budget, in 6 years. And to do that without relying on, rhetoric that sounds good but just can't be substantiated is completely unrealistic. It requires basically three things: continued downward pressure on the budget, the operating budget. It requires a broad-based revenue source, including what the question asks, or it could be other, it could be a statewide sales tax. There's sort of other options, and it includes restructure the permanent fund, all three. And there's no credible budget proposal in Alaska right now that does not involve those three, that mathematically balances. That is just a hard and cold truth. And what happens is, when people don't recognize that truth, is what happens the last 6 years, which is the legislature has flushed away about $15 billion in savings because it's much more convenient to spend down savings than to look at the hard, cold truth of what will balance the budget in Alaska. And to me, that's unconscionable. It's been one of the most frustrating things I've seen. I think it's a matter of intergenerational equity when you flush away that kind of savings. And you do it because it's easier than making the hard decisions that balance the budget. So the answer is yes, I support a balanced budget.
This question is for Jonathan. Representative Chris Tompkins from KCAW listener Patty. Our city leaders got us into building a dam with electrical bills that cannot pay the principal on the loan. There's no way that a town this size could possibly pay off the debt. What would you do to help us with this impossible situation?
It's a difficult situation, and I defer to local leaders like Dr. Ween on the assembly and the current assembly for a path forward. I mean, I continue to be hopeful that actually might be federal funds. I had a meeting with Mayor Paxton and Keith Brady, the city administrator, today talking about that. But in terms of the state of Alaska's role, I mean, as everybody knows, we're awash in red ink as it is, and the prospect of $50 million coming down from on high isn't realistic. I mean, one of the consequences of not balancing our budget is there is $0 capital budget in Alaska. We can't get state money, or it's very hard to get state money to rebuild a dilapidated police station, much less direct $10 or $20 or $50 million to the dam. So, I mean, until Alaska's fiscal house is in order, the state of Alaska's ability to help communities like Sitka is very limited. But I certainly support a creative approach to the problem, and maybe there's something on the federal level that could be helpful.
Dr. Wayne?
God helps those that help themselves. I think we need a vibrant state economy. It is that economy that feeds all the infrastructure around the state. Whether you realize it or not, since oil was discovered, 85% of the unrestricted funding has been from oil. It is 27% of our gross state product, and the reason I bring that up is if we have a diversified economy, if we support, there are 400,000 barrels that are very close to entering the pipeline now, and then if we support all aspects, whether it's resource development, business, et cetera, obviously in a smart way, support the fisheries, mariculture, and develop a economy, then I think that we may be able to request funds, you know, for the dam. The dam was a mistake in its funding, and I can pontificate at length for that, but I will have to stop.
At this time, we will allow the candidates to ask one question to each other. Based on our coin toss at the beginning, Representative Cress Tompkins will ask his first. Each candidate will have 2 minutes to respond.
All right, my turn. I guess my question, are you supporting Mike Dunleavy for governor?
The answer is yes. My question to you is, are you going to vote yes or no on Proposition 1?
I'm going to defer to what the voters say on that issue.
Can I ask another? And by the way, I wear armor boxer jocks briefs. That was a question asked to Obama, what type of briefs he had. So just in case anybody was interested.
You can ask one more question of each other, but it means you will only have 1 minute for a closing statement. So. Would you prefer 2 minutes?
I would prefer a closing statement.
Great. Okay.
Carrie Beth? We will end the program with closing statements by each candidate. Dr. Wien will go first, and he will have 2 minutes to speak.
As I said today at the chamber, one of the lessons I've learned in the political process is I am not a politician. And what is politics? It's a Greek word, politika, meaning polis from city, and it means the affairs of the city. And the joke is the other definition is poly, meaning many, and ticks, meaning blood-sucking parasites. And so I leave it to you to decide on what definition it should be. I'm not a politician, and part of that is, as a physician and surgeon, I face reality, and I have to deal with reality, and therefore I have to speak reality. And what I mean by that is I will tell you exactly where I stand, etc. And I will always do that, and that's why I will say I stand for smart resource development, in whether it be mining, timber, etc. I stand for voting no on Proposition 1. I stand for the exemption rule, and I have reasons for all of these. And the most important thing I stand for is to develop a vibrant economy in the state of Alaska, and by having everything on the table. As a surgeon, I have to think of all the consequences and all the possibilities, and therefore I have to be prepared for that. And as an economy, we also need to be prepared for everything. And therefore, I feel not only from a healthcare issue due to my special knowledge, but I feel that we are first and last in all the wrong things, and we need to start having the consequences and not accept these aspects in our lives. There are many things that are not spoken of that I will speak of as a legislator, and we'll bring these to the fore and hopefully improve you know, our state. Thank you.
Representative Cress Tompkins, go ahead.
I I was born here in Sitka. I grew up here. I live here. I care about this community. I care about this region. And it's been meaningful to me the last 6 years to represent this part of Alaska in the House of Representatives. And I'd be honored to continue to do that for 2 more years. And I'm proud of what I've been a part of accomplishing. And I want to speak to a couple of those points that are important to me. I've been involved in ethics and good government legislation, which has been hugely important, I think, to the institution of the legislature and making it more responsive and accountable to the people it represents. I co-chaired the PFD Automatic Voter Registration Initiative, which makes voter registration a non-issue in Alaska. We have the best voter registration system of any state in the history of the United States, and that's a fact. That's something that I was involved in, and I'm very proud to see as the law of the land. There was an ethics bill this year passed in the legislature, and that instituted a no-budget, no-pay provision. All the games of chicken about the legislature going to the brink of government shutdown every year, it is my firm hope will be history. That won't happen again. And that was a problem, and I wanted to see a solution, and we got the solution. The loophole that allows lobbyists to wine and dine legislators over $100, $150 meals at SALT in downtown Juneau night after night, that is no longer going to happen. So that's something I've been very proud of. I believe in supporting a constitutional amendment that fully protects the permanent fund, that constitutionalizes the dividend at a sustainable level. And I support the bipartisan coalition, which is one of the best things going for this community and this region, especially in the face of a Dunleavy administration, which has proposed a 12.5% tax on commercial fishing and could really be anathema to coastal Alaska. So if I serve for 2 more years, if I have your support, those will be my priorities, and I really appreciate your consideration this election.
Thank you to the candidates. Thank you to the students. Election day is Tuesday, November 6th.